Well, welcome to the Center for Great Plains Studies and this Paul A. Olson seminar. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker this afternoon. Wynn Summers is a native of Lincoln who earned her BA at Montana State University, her MS at the Utah State University, and she returned to Lincoln for her PhD at the University of Nebraska. She's an assistant professor of English at Southern Utah University, where she teaches creative writing, literature, and culture courses. She's the author of the book titled Women's Elder Life Stories of the Omaha Tribe in Macy, Nebraska. You may have seen that you can purchase one of these out front, and I'm sure she would be happy to sign it for you, too. The title of her presentation this afternoon is Importance of Elders for Culture, Continuity, and Sovereignty.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Thank you. So I kind of like to open, I will do a reading, but I'll tell you how I would like to have this go. I'm going to talk about life stories, and life stories are very intriguing in different ways. Thomas King, who is a native writer, says, watch out when you tell a story, because stories are wondrous and powerful things. So I kind of want to open by asking you about your stories. And when I talk about culture continuity and sovereignty, I'm talking about why storytelling grounds us in our self-identity and how it helps us define who we are in the world. So you didn't know when you came here you'd be doing this, right? Sharing your stories? You're shaking your head no. Okay. So you'll be doing the lecture today. I'm just going to be observing. So I'd like to start, and I would like you to tell me what of a story is that you feel grounds you in the world, or a story told about you, something that you want to share that you think speaks to you in a powerful way or informs who you are in the world. Stories are very powerful. Leslie Silco, who is Laguna Pueblo, she actually wrote a poem, and the poem is about witches, and they're all gathering together, and they're going to talk about the world. And so they're casting spells, they're putting all sorts of things into a pot. And all of a sudden, the very last one to go says, wait a minute, I've got a story. And she talks about colonization. And she talks about all the things coming when Anglo-Europeans are going to come onto the land that have been inhabited by native people, indigenous people. And the witches all get around, and she's spinning this long story. And they become quite terrified. And they say, wait a minute, call it back. We don't want that story. We don't want that story to get out there. And she says, it's too late. I've already let it out into the world. So now I've really scared you, and you'll never tell another story. But I guess the point is that when you let a story out into the world, it has great power. Language is a very powerful thing to work with. And when I was working with Omaha elders, it was a very fun experience for me, because by sharing our stories, we became very close. And by sharing our stories, we came to realize that we weren't that different. So our life stories were very common. But life stories are very powerful in unique ways, because they speak to who we are and they speak to how we ground ourselves in the world that we inhabit. So I always like to start out with that. I will tell you a short story about my name, and then I promise I'll get to the book. My dad was in New Guinea during the war. He was there for quite a long time. And he almost died in the New Guinea jungles. He had a friend named Kevin who carried him out. So, of course, when my mother became pregnant with me, what would you surmise my name to be for 9 months? Yes, Kevin. I always teased him and said, oh, it could be Kevinette. But I came out, of course, like this. So they were panicked. Oh, my gosh, she was supposed to be Kevin for 9 months. They went to the last name in the name book, and it was Wynn. So that story has sort of informed who I am, because everybody says, how did you get that name, Wynn? Is it short for something? And I say, no, it's just Wynn. It was the last name in the name book. It's not glamorous. It's not after anyone. Just the last name in the name book. So before I do a reading, I'll tell you a little bit about how this started. I was doing my dissertation work. I was taking the Omaha language with Dr. Mark Awakuni Swetland here at UNL. I took 4 semesters of the Omaha language. I can say Rory is here, so he teaches in the Omaha language class. I was briefing him before saying, I'm trying to remember how to say the red squirrel ran up the tree. And I probably won't be able to recite it right now, but it was a wonderful class. I wanted to do something with the Omaha culture after I finished. And Mark said, why don't you think about doing place names? Place names are really interesting in Macy, And why don't you go there and talk about place names and see what the stories are behind why things are named. So I did that. I went to Macy. I met with the tribal council to get permission to work on the reservation. And the tribal chairman was very friendly. In fact, he said, you know, I may need to contact you. What's your phone number? And I gave him the last four digits, 1880. And he said, was that a treaty year? And we kind of joked about my number being similar to maybe a disastrous treaty of some kind. But we got to know each other. He said I had permission to work on the Macy Reservation. So I went around and I tried to talk to people about place names, and I got nowhere. They didn't want to talk about place names. And I went to the senior center, and there was a lady sitting there, and I sat with her, and I said, do you know any places around here or stories that connect with these places? And she said, no. But wait a minute. And she pulled out her wallet. She opened up the wallet. She showed me all kinds of pictures of her children, her grandchildren. And she said, I really don't want to talk to you about places, but I want to tell you my life story. So I thought, well, this is really interesting. So I didn't get out my recorder or anything. I just sat and listened. And she told me all about her life in Macy. And I thought, this may be the direction I want to go. So there was another woman I talked to, another elder in the community, and I went down to her house. She had a greenhouse that was kind of at the end of the reservation, and the snowplow had run through her gate. So she said I could come in if I fixed her gate. So it was a little heavy, so I couldn't actually fix her gate. But I went in to talk to her about place names, and she said, I'm not too interested in that. What I am interested in, though, is telling you about my life here on Macy, and I want to talk to you about that. So that prompted another life story. And everywhere I went, I kept getting life stories. So I did finally meet with three women elders in Macy that became very close friends of mine. We worked together for about 2 years. And I recorded their stories. I transcribed their stories. I took them back to make sure I was correctly transcribing their stories. So it was quite a long process. 3 years later, after many copy edits and finally graduating, of course, and then turning the dissertation into a book, it's been a really incredible experience. So I wanted to give you some contextual grounding of how the book came about. And I'll read a chapter from the book. And then it has poetry in it, too, because I think poetry is a way of looking at language in a very profound way. And then I would like to open it up to you for questions. So if you have questions, I love to have Q&A after I do a reading, because I like to feel like we're all part of the same thing. So jot down questions or anything you might want to talk about. I won't scare you with stories, I promise. Although after I'm done, you'll probably have a whole lot you want to say. Okay, I'd like to start with a poem, and then I'll start with the first chapter and then kind of combine it with poems. Lines between worlds say much about who we are, who we are going to be, our lives in between, white and Indian, Indian and white, cultures drawn and interwoven between worlds, shadowlands, borderlands of life. But I am caught in between, living in both, breathing in both, working in both. Does that tell you who I am? Stories spoke the first word and brought me from the edges of two places. So carefully drawn, etched in stone, in tobacco, in smoke. I am the woman in the story, and the story is me. An Omaha woman, a proud woman, weaver of dreams, woman of means, storyteller. Okay, so like I say, if you have questions, jot down while I read. In the spring of 2005, Omaha tribal member Eleanor Baxter and I got into her car and headed north from the tribal council building in Macy, Nebraska. The day was warm. Spring grasses grew along the banks and high hills surrounding the reservation. Earlier, Eleanor had talked about taking me on a tour of the Macy Reservation. That morning seemed like the right time. I'm going to take you to our cemetery, she said. I had passed the cemetery many times heading toward the town of Macy from the north. It was on my left as I headed downhill to the main area of the reservation. But this is only a part of the reservation, which was surrounded by rolling hills and verdant with new crop growth, raspberry bushes, and giant cottonwoods hugging the Missouri River. Not far from Macy was Big Elk Park, marked by lush wooded hills and a rich canopy of trees. Houses dotted the landscape in all directions, set on the land in circular patterns that led back to the town. The cemetery always caught my eye. was placed on a hilltop overlooking the council building, the C-store, the rows of houses, and the senior center. It was a marker against time. Eleanor had spent her early childhood in Macy before moving to Lincoln as a young girl, and as she talked, I heard in her voice the tug of emotion and connection to land and place that now informed her life. That morning, before we left the council building for the tour, Eleanor told me the story of a young woman whose car had careened off the highway heading east from Walt Hill earlier in the week, killing her. The woman left a grandmother, a husband, and small children. There was to be a funeral later that morning. "I've got time to show you around before everything starts," she said. She took me over to the community center where the funeral was to be held. I met the grandmother, stoic in her grief. She had lost a son earlier that year. The deaths seemed too many to endure. So it seemed ironic to begin at the cemetery where there was so much sorrow. Yet starting where ancestors and family were buried seemed appropriate when it came to returning to one's roots and the place of one's birth, paying homage to those who went before. It was sacred landscape. Eleanor pointed to a fresh mound outside the car window. "That's where the girl will be buried, and that's where Timothy Santosi is buried. He was a young man of 23, came home from Lincoln at 17, and then my parents raised him. He had three kids and was killed. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of him because he hurt us all so badly because of the love we had for him." The word home, sorry, I'm losing my voice already. The word home resonated. Lincoln was not home, even though he had lived there. Macy was. Caretakers could no longer take care of the graves because of money shortages. Eleanor said they did have people who cared for them, however. Years ago, they had old-timers. When there was a death, there was a group of men that used to just automatically go. Everything was done. They just went and did it out of the goodness of their heart. "These are all my family here, my mother, May Blackbird Santosi. She asked me to look carefully at the gravestones. They had teepees on them." She pointed to where her father, Oliver, was buried. "He was what they call a roadman, a minister in the Native American church. He officiated at all the birthdays and dinners and burials. The car wove along the roads that marked the circles of mounds. Eleanor said the mounds were part of their culture, that it seemed strange to have everything flat. She took me to an old part of the cemetery where her grandparents were buried. I took pictures of some of the old stones, which dated back to the early 1800s. Uphill from these old markers was a military circle, profuse with graves. Eleanor told me about the time she was a speaker on a panel and was asked to ask by a young lady what her people had contributed to the United States. It was quite violent then. I could have went off on a tangent because I just told them in a way that we contributed to the government, gave them our land. We didn't give them our land. It was taken from us. We served in all the wars. And this military circle is where our veterans are. There are fresh mounds among the old. See all the mounds? Those are the ones that died. "This is sacred land," she said. She was a wise woman who was very old. Maybe Grandmother Spider. I saw her in my dreams when she came to me with eyes round and hard, cold and dark. The voices of the land were everywhere, in trees, in grass blades, in houses. They were everywhere, these voices, hushed into sacred places and roots of trees and soil and wind, water. When the government took the land, they took the blood and bones of ancestors lying deep in the earth, took them without thinking of the consequences. She stopped to look at me with eyes gone black, raven eyes turned inward, into the blue-tipped wings, sing into orbs of silence, where blood runs in rivers and cries are still heard echoing in canyons. Secret places, ancient sorrows run deep. I heard the blackbirds rise from the branches, circle the land. Once the sacredness is stolen, she said, it is over. Eleanor and I left the cemetery and drove downhill toward what she called HUD Housing, an urban development federal program. Here's Tower Hill. This is where we begin to get street names. We're doing that because we have to have physical addresses now instead of using post office boxes. It used to be called ADC, Age Dependent Children Hill. That's just how Indian humor is, she said. They can pick on each other the worst. And these are some of the housing circles. Some of the housing units here were just remodeled, so they look pretty good. One housing circle was called Thunder Circle. I asked who picked the names. She told me her daughter Shannon had been one of those who helped pick names, and that two or three people get to decide. These are all the Fannie Mae and HUD housing units. 18 more units are going to be built. We left the housing area and headed into the rural countryside. There's people buried all over the reservation, Eleanor said. That's the way it was done back in the days of the prairie. The land stretched to the horizon, open and undulating. The bones of the people that lay on this land anchored it as a kind of talisman against loss and land losses and future depredations, well known to the Omaha. This is our land here, Eleanor said as we drove. I can truly say this is our reservation because we weren't removed. This is our land here. When I came back, I had to know. I knew I was Indian, and I knew where I came from, but to go back to history, I had to relearn again and know dates and times. We circled around from a more rural area to the southeast, past more houses to what was termed the Horse Project. Eleanor said it was for the kids to help them with emotional problems. She explained that the kids take care of the horses and learn to ride them. We turned and drove north uphill to a brick building. This is our college, NICC, she said, Nebraska Indian Community College. It's accredited now. Alice Santisi teaches language there. Downhill from NICC were more houses, what Eleanor called the West Projects. I asked her if she felt reconnected with Omaha tradition and culture since she had moved back from Lincoln much later in her life. I was always in it anyway. It was one thing I never lost was the customs, the traditions, the way we live. I never lost that thought. We turned west and headed out from Yellow Smoke Road to the Bureau Roads. The car stirred up dust which lingered on the edges of the glass and in the cracks of the doors. I wished for rain. But now the hills were beginning to show green and the ditches were full of raspberry bushes. We were north of Yellow Smoke Road. There's all kinds of shortcuts to get to Highway 77, she said. Any road you take west is going to lead you. When we were kids, this whole creek here, Blackbird Creek, it widens. And this is where I grew up, around this area before we moved to Lincoln. Back then, we didn't have bicycles, anything. Everything we did was walk. Walk, 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 and our food was squirrels, rabbits, even raccoons. I kind of grimaced when she said that. She said her brothers were the hunters. The trees which they cut for their wood stoves kept them warm in the winter. Everybody had a wood stove. We didn't have gas, electricity. We had lamps. These creeks here, we used to pick gooseberries, raspberries, and look for morel mushrooms. And you can dry those. They're found all over. Sometimes I can remember there were so many mushrooms. I can remember filling baths and tubs and everything up with mushrooms, and then we'd dry them. They'd shrivel up to marble size. This is our play area where we were small. Raspberry and gooseberry bushes grew thick along Blackbird Creek. Eleanor cautioned me about poison ivy. Houses were scattered at different directions on the hillsides. She pointed out where some once stood that were now gone and others that remained solidly on the land. These were my stomping ground, she reminisced. I heard the longing in her voice. We stopped at the place where she was born, a two-story wood frame house on the corner of the Bureau Roads. Some of her family relations came out to see who had pulled in the driveway. We visited briefly while two dogs, eager for attention, circled around me. Conversation died away. Eleanor got back in the car, and I jumped in beside her. This time we headed west toward Black Elk Park, toward the old mission school. I'd take you up there, but it looks pretty rough. If you go right over the trees there, there are some old gravestones, and there's a foundation where the school was. And the first time her voice trailed off. When I moved back, I told my husband, take me up there. When I got up there, I felt the most peaceful feeling of serenity. And I'd read Francis LaFleche's book, The Middle Five, about boarding schools to civilize Indians. And I wanted to go up there. I envisioned all the little kids just running around up there. And I thought, boy, you could get lost in a time capsule up there. I felt peaceful. Other people have told me they felt uncomfortable and they had to get out of there. The old mission school has long since disappeared, the woman told me. The one with the hard black eyes that had seen everything. She showed me around in my dreams. There's only this old stone foundation, this line of stones, she pointed. But there's where the fireplace stood. Maybe that's where it was. I don't remember. I was only a girl then. They cut your hair at boarding school and put you in strange clothes. And said you could never speak your native language again. They stole that from us, the language, along with the land. They beat it out of us. They washed us as our skin lay in shreds on the ground. And then they kicked it into dust. And then when it was all over, when it was all said and done, we went home to the reservation and didn't know what it was like to be Indian. Now we are trying to catch up, trying to resurrect those things that were important to us. You know, when they take your soul, what's left? Eleanor showed me where an old house used to be, downhill and to the west of the mission site, in a grove of trees and bushes. She pointed ahead to a winding dirt road, deeply rutted. This led up to the holy fireplace. The holy fireplace is where our people used to go and fast. And we were told not to go up there because it was sacred ground. It's all fenced off. She said that people still go there to look off the bluff that looks down into the hole in the rock. The holy fireplace is located along the Missouri Bluffs, not far from Council Point, and is considered a sacred spot where the forefathers handed down Omaha ceremonies. Stabler discussed Omaha legend connected to this spot. The people were old and poor and wished to gain strength through prayers to Wakonda. They took their young boys, about 12 or 13 years old, to a hill to pray for 4 days without eating or drinking. On the fourth day, at the height of weakness, a vision or dream was given to those who had endured the ritual of fasting and praying. A song was associated with this vision. The song became a medium of communication between the visionary and the object of his dream. Throughout his life, the dream or vision and the song became his help and strength in the hour of need. After the vision, which is referred to as Najinjan, did I say that right, Rory? Okay. To stand sleeping, the youth returned to his family but remained solitary, eating and resting. I have past Omaha language people here with me, so it's great. I can check things out with them. After the fourth day, the vision was shared with an old man who had experienced a similar vision. If the youth spoke of the vision before the 4 days, it would be lost to him. Stabler reinforced how this ritual brought communication with Wakonda, the Great Spirit. Eleanor drove into the parking lot of the Tribal Council building. She parked the car and said she had to prepare for the funeral of the girl who had recently died. I thanked her for the time we spent together that morning and watched her walk away from me. From inside the community center came the sound of the drums and voices rising and falling like soft ripples on Blackbird Creek as it wound through the hills. On May 16th, 2005, I returned to Macy to visit with Omaha language teacher Alice Santosi. We met at the Omaha Tribal Council building. She wanted to drive out into the countryside to show me her old childhood school, Macaulay. By now, the land around Macy was alive with color. The prairie grass is deep green and purple, blue in the spring winds. I could feel their energy as a palpable presence. As we headed west, the land stretched behind us. Raspberry and gooseberry bushes were coming to life in the ditches and along the edges of the road. Alice commented that no one ate them anymore because of all the herbicides and chemicals farmers used on their fields. I remembered Eleanor's childhood stories of gathering berries and eating them and felt saddened by the loss of such food. We drove south and then east past the old school. I took a picture. The school bell, once anchored in the ruins, was missing, the windows gaping and empty like hollow eye sockets. But the charm remained. It was near a creek where Alice said she and her friends used to play. She talked about the neighbors she remembered, the German family across from her grandfather's place, who were long gone. She explained how she didn't live with her father and stepmother, but they were close by, so she did go there to help with chores or to visit. I am reminded of the first time I met Alice and she talked about her return to the land, to the home place of Macy from Lincoln, where she had lived since 1965. Her husband Frank was ill and told the family he wanted to go home. He said, we're going to go back to Macy to survive. After the move, she attended the Nebraska Indian Community College in Macy and graduated in 1991. Her speech instructor asked her what she wanted to do in 10 years. I said that 10 years from now, I want to come back to be a speaker, keynote speaker. And I also want to serve on the board of directors, board of trustees at the college. 13 years later, I'm on the board, and I was a keynote speaker. I got out of the car and took a picture of Macaulay. Alice stood next to me. Alice said she has good memories of her rural childhood in Macy, and that she will always treasure the memories of her grandparents. But the area has changed significantly. The children she went to school with are now scattered about. Many of the farmers in that area lost their land and moved to the city of Omaha to survive. One of these families used to live across from her. Her memories are framed by those no longer there, those who moved on and have left behind shadows of their childhood experiences. We stood for a few more minutes, feeling the wind on our faces. It's harsher now, pressing the grasses flat and rattling the dry corn stalks from last year's planting. One of these days, she might be alive, or maybe she isn't, Alice said. Maybe I walk past her and don't know it, but she was my teacher, and all of us that were there, we never called her Miss Ferguson. We called her Punky, because that was her name. So one of these days, maybe I'll run into Punky. The drive ended at Alice's house east of Macy. It was a rectangular brick home with the poles of a sweat lodge in the yard. She showed me where she wanted a garden, but commented that it was too overgrown with weeds. The farmer, she explained, who could plow it for her and turn the soil, had not shown up to help. I asked if I could take her picture. She walked over and stood under a tree next to her house. Her lips moved silently as the camera button clicked. Alice stands under the tree in the late spring, the one with leaves just coming out, catching the wind. She's in Levi's and has a wool coat on with colored geometric designs. Her gray-black hair is sleek, shiny, pulled back into a long braid. She's regal. The breeze catches the edge of her coat, makes creases in her jeans. Her dark eyes look back at me as I catch her image in the viewfinder. The square shape of the camera's window brings her into focus. With a click, she is imprinted forever. But I see her spirit there, flying over the trees, laughing. She is the sky. Later, I would come to know another elder, Hawate, also named Winona Karamoni. She also had returned to Macy as an older woman and assisted the Omaha community as an educator and language teacher. But when I held Alice's image in the frame of the camera, I thought of only one thing. In return, there is rebirth. Sacred landscape, land imbued with spiritual presence through these women's stories. Beyond physicality into sacrality. Landscape is a thread that combines the elements of storytelling and is a way of preserving cultural and spiritual life and survival. I take a shortcut to Highway 77 along Yellow Smoke Road. The dust grinds beneath the tires and spins underneath, leaving small brown whirlpools. Earth being, I search for you in the stories of women everywhere, in the cloth of women's lives, shared and unabated callings that speak of crossings, comings and goings, homeland, Ujela, in Omaha language means weary. I am weary of the crossings, but in return, there is hope. Thanks.